This is the Financial Sense News Hour. Now, here's the Financial Sense News Team, Jim Poplava and John Loeffler.
Welcome back to the Financial Sense News Hour. Jim Poplava, John Loeffler here. This is the part of the program which we refer to as the big picture, in which we attempt to inject sense to all of the data points that you see out there. The world is awash in data points, both economically and politically. And what does all of this mean? You know, if we look back on 2017, trying to put some sense into what we've seen this whole year, 2017 was a year full of surprises. Stock market is up double digits. Nobody really expected that. The Fed will have raised for three times for the first time in the cycle, three consecutive times. They will have raised interest rates. But despite the hike in interest rates at the Fed, interest rates generally have been muted. After 8 years or so of economic growth, finally, the economy's back to firing on all cylinders and growing at a 3% rate. And inflation at the same time has remained relatively tame. Elsewhere, we're seeing synchronized global economic growth as well as rising stock markets globally. Investors are starting to become euphoric. I'm not sure if that's good or bad or not, if not that complacent when it comes to, say, for example, Bitcoin going up 40% in less than 40 hours. But investors do have a lot to be cheerful about, as all investments in all asset classes have done well. That's 2017, but here we are. We're right at the beginning of December, rounding out the end of the year. What about 2018, right around the corner? And that's going to be our subject, 2018.
You know, as we look back, John, I'm just thinking of where we were at the beginning of the year. The Fed had announced in December that they were likely to raise three times, or interest rates three times, which was significant in itself because up until this time, they talked about raising rates multiple times, but they were only able to do it once a year. They did it once in 2015, and they did it once in 2016. So the markets were a little bit fearful as we began the year, but this Trump rally continued ever since the election. Well into this year, it's been a very good year, and it's helped by policies in Washington with deregulation. We have also seen low inflation this year and surprisingly low interest rates and optimism over the coming tax cuts, which has been driving this market, especially as the Republicans really accelerate this tax cut, especially coming back after the August recess, because they had failed to repeal Obamacare. They failed in their first attempt to cut taxes, so nobody was really expecting anything. Then all of a sudden, momentum started to build as the Republicans realize next year is an election year. And what do you tell the voters? You control all branches of government and you were unable to deliver something. So the momentum began to pick up over tax reform, and the likelihood of tax cuts is fueling much of this rally that we've seen in the fourth quarter and has the potential of extending this business cycle and bull market into next year. Now, we're talking about, if you take a look at this, in just simple static accounting, you're talking about $150 billion in stimulus. You're also talking about cutting tax rates from 35% to 20%. So you can imagine what that's going to do for corporate earnings. So we could see, at least in my opinion, as you look at all of this, a very good first half in 2018.
Well, now, why not another good year like this year? What about the second half of 2018?
You know, as you look at this, there's three things that come to mind. Number one, Fed rate hikes could become aggressive as the Fed reacts to this stimulus. In fact, we've had several Fed governors, including Dudley, saying that, you know what, we may need to take it up a notch if this stimulus starts to heat up the economy. Now, the economy has only grown at 3%, so you could hardly call that as overheating. I mean, if we were growing at 4.5%, 5%, inflation was running at 4, 3, 4, 5%, you could say that. But that's where it is right now, and we'll talk about why that's beginning to heat up. Number two, the Fed taper itself is going to remove a large buyer in the Treasury market. Now, when they fully implement this, remember, they're going to increase it $10 billion per month per quarter. So right now, they're letting $10 billion roll off every single month. That's going to increase to $20 billion in January, and it'll increase to $30 billion in April. So you are removing a large buyer of treasuries at a time the budget deficit is increasing. It's projected that next year we could see a $700 to $800 billion budget deficit for the government. And number three, you've got market valuations that are overextended by any stretch of the imagination. Now, if rates begin to rise, both on the short end and on the long end, rising yields could offset rising earnings per share in 2018, leading to a topping process in stocks. And the other thing I think that the markets aren't expecting, we're going to get into this in just a moment, is nobody's expecting rising inflation.
Yeah, and we do know, Jim, that when the Fed sees inflation starts to rise, they get pretty aggressive with policy and with their rate hikes to try to curtail it.
Yeah, if oil prices rise and remain elevated, the dollar remains weak, wage inflation continues, we could see inflation to begin to pick up, which, as you just mentioned, John, is going to prompt the Fed to get more aggressive. So it'll be interesting to watch the press conferences that are going to accompany these FOMC meetings and the minutes that come out in terms of what they're saying going forward. However, here's the real issue. The opportunities remain elevated for policy mistakes and the unintended consequences that accompany them. The chief one that we have been talking about here on the program is you now have fiscal and monetary policy that are no longer in sync and have actually become two opposing forces.
And we need to point out too, Jim, that the Fed's also unwinding their balance sheet, which, as best I know, they haven't done that before.
You know, they haven't. I mean, up until the financial crisis, the Fed's balance sheet, which had grown over half a century, was only about $800 billion. Today, it's at $4.5 trillion. And just as when they began to initiate quantitative easing in 2009, it was poorly understood. And I find it incredibly hard to believe that the experts could tell us that as they begin quantitative tightening, which is what they're going to do as they roll off these bonds and don't renew them, that they can predictably tell us that we're going to have a benign outcome. And there are a couple things that really strike me about this. Number one, tightening as GDP finally hits 3%, it has taken us 9 years to get there, and the Fed could end that. I mean, it's not like when you go back to the financial crisis, when you had the economy growing at almost 3.5 to 4%, and then you had inflation at the 4 to 5% level. John, we're nowhere near that. We only have inflation 2% or under, and it has basically taken us 9 years to get to a 3% economic growth. We just got there. So, you know, assuming the fourth quarter comes in as expected, it'll be a little over 3%. You know, you can't really say that this is really overheating. So, I mean, this is just ripe for that. But what we do see happening right now, and you're seeing it in trends with some of the economic reports that came out on Friday, is number one, U.S. producer prices were up 2.8% year over year. That's the largest increase in 5 years. They have been rising since late 2015. And they started to accelerate in the second half of 2016 and 2017. So this will only encourage the Fed with the tightening process. In number two, as Greg Weldon and I discussed in the first hour, debt is starting to accelerate. The Fed reported on Tuesday that household debt rose almost $13 trillion, up nearly 1% from the spring. And this is the 13th consecutive straight quarterly increase in debt. The other thing the Fed reported is debt delinquencies have risen to 4.9%. Most of that $13 trillion in debt, I'm rounding off here, is in mortgages, auto loans, and student loans make up the majority of all of that debt. So as we see the Fed keep raising rates, it's going to make carrying that debt become more expensive and make taking on new debt even worse. In other words, as borrowing costs go higher, it makes it harder for people to qualify for mortgages. Home equity loans start to go. A lot of lending is tied to prime rate. That starts to go up. So all of a sudden now you have debt levels that are high, and then that debt begins to become more expensive. So one of the problems that we saw leading up to the financial crisis, when debt really began to rise in 2006 and 7, when I mean not only debt levels, but also the interest rate on that debt, and especially a lot of those kind of junk mortgages that were out there that were variable and adjusted. Now, the one good thing that's positive about all this debt is consumers, especially when it comes to mortgages, have been able to lock in long-term low interest rates. So that is, at least on the mortgage side, there doesn't seem to be any problems. Where the problems exist of all that debt are in two areas: student loans and auto loans. You're seeing delinquency rates above 11% on student loans, and you're seeing delinquency rates start to rise on auto loans. So those are the debt issues that are out there. So what do you have? You have rising debt that is now going to experience rising interest rates to carry that debt. And number two, you have rising inflation rates.
So what is going to drive then the gains of the first half versus what we anticipate might happen in the second half of 2018?
I still believe we're going to get a tax bill that is going to accelerate corporate earnings and GDP growth heading into next year. So we could see the economy and the stock markets respond well in the first part of the year. We're looking at 2017. The fourth quarter should come in at a 3% economic growth rate. So that trend should accelerate into 2018 in the first half of the year.
Okay, what do you think could spoil that trend? I mean, if everything looks pretty positive.
Well, a number of things. Rising inflation. Rising inflation leads to rising interest rates, and rising inflation also leads to more aggressive Fed tightening. So if inflation rises as GDP does, the result of, let's say, fiscal stimulus, you may see the Fed get more aggressive, and they've already hinted at it. And so that's why I say it is 2018 is ripe for policy mistakes, because now you don't have monetary and fiscal policy in sync as we did in the 2001 recession and the 2007 recession. Now we have them as opposing forces. So you combine that with, let's say, removing quantitative easing and the Fed shrinking its balance sheet, which is the biggest buyer in the Treasury market, you could see rates rise, let's say, on the 10-year note, on the upper 2% range, and then the 30-year note or bond, you could see that rise into the 3-3.5% level, which is going to drive up borrowing costs, and that's going to spread across the economy from student loans. It's going to affect mortgage rates. It's going to affect home equity loans. It's going to affect credit card debt. All of this is going to translate into the higher cost of carrying debt, or let's say taking on new debt.
Well, I guess it's always a matter of timing to some degree. So the real question is, when does it all arrive and what are you watching to indicate that?
Well, I mean, it's always difficult forecasting a recession. It could be very difficult. I mean, it's not a precise science. You can't say, well, you know, in the middle of March next year, we're going to begin a recession. You never know until looking backwards. For example, the stock market peaked in October of 2007, and the recession was dated December of 2007, and we really didn't know it until the middle of 2008 that we were actually in a recession. So there are things that can happen that can extend an economic recovery or postpone it, and most of them deal with fiscal and monetary policy. And a good example is taking Fed policy itself. You know, they announced in May of 2013, they were going to start tapering, stop printing money. That ended at the end of 2014. They had their first rate hike in 2015. But John, they begin each year and they'd say, all right, we're going to raise it two or three times. In 2015, they only raised it once because of all the things that were going on internationally and in the economy. Likewise, in 2016, this year is the first year in a four-year rate raising cycle that began in the summer of 2013 with the announcement of tapering, that the Fed has been able to actually follow through on what it projected at the beginning of the year. They said three rate hikes, and it's almost a 100% probability that we're going to get the third rate hike this year. So those Fed rate hike delays kept interest rates low, and now what you have been interjecting in beginning in January of 2018. Assuming this tax bill goes into place, you will be able to adjust your tax withholding. That's what Republicans hope, and they're going to urge people to do. So if your taxes are going to go down, what you do is you adjust your paycheck, your tax withholding. Those are putting dollars in your pocket. And those are the kind of things that can extend an economic cycle.
Yeah, but Jim, ultimately, we know what Fed hikes ultimately lead to. And the question is, why has it taken so long, this economic cycle?
You know, John, you got to take a look at in the last economic downturn, let's say that the recession that we had in 2001, Greenspan brought rates down to 1%, began to raise them quarterly every FOMC meeting. And then in this last recession, they brought interest rates down to zero. So we're starting from a zero base. And the economy, don't forget, in the entire previous 8 years under Obama, the economy only grew at 2%. Many times it was below 1%. So they weren't in a position either on the inflation front or on the economic front to say, hey, we need to aggressively start raising rates here because the economy is overheating along with inflation. That simply did not exist. And the problem, as always, is that they've had to walk back on so many of the things that they projected, because this economic cycle has been different than any that has preceded it. And that's why it has taken longer to get where we've gone.
But to reiterate what we've said many, many times on the program here, predictably, we know how this is going to end when they start into a rate raising cycle. Something is going to break, and that's their indicator as to when they've gone too far. They don't seem to have any other indicators that work.
No, I mean, monetary policy always acts with a lag. So it's kind of like going down a hill and you start picking up speed. And that's what happens when you start raising rates. What happens is the side effects begin to show up gradually, and then they accelerate. The problem, as always, as business cycle ages and the Fed rate cycle continues, the changes, it becomes increasingly vulnerable to policy mistakes. Look at bursting asset bubbles. You know, Bitcoin is just one that stands out that could happen. Or outside shocks. You take a look at the oil shocks that we experienced late 2007 and 2008 when oil prices rose to $150 a barrel. But we know historically business cycles follow a fairly predictable pattern leading up to a recession. So there are things that you can watch and look at that give you a clue that, you know, we're heading in that direction. Number one, what you typically see is the labor market begins to tighten. Economists call something, it's called basically the unemployment gap, which is the difference between the unemployment rate and the natural rate of employment. And what happens is a strong labor market generally prompts the Fed to tighten, because an unemployment rate well below this natural rate is unsustainable by definition and can lead to a spike in wages and price inflation. So if you look at the current cycle, the labor market is in the early stages of overheating. And it is projected that next year, if it continues, we could see an unemployment rate at 3.5%. We got the job report on Friday for the month of November. 228,000 jobs were created, and the unemployment rate was 4.1%, which represents a 17-year low. The second thing that you can see is that the Fed policy gets into real increase in interest rates. In other words, the interest rate is above the inflation rate. And the Fed has usually hiked rates beyond what is called the natural rate to cool the labor market and get ahead of inflation. The problem is they're always looking through the rearview mirror. They're not looking through the front mirror and saying, all right, let's raise rates, stand back, watch things for a couple months and see how things are progressing. Is inflation heating up? Is the economy heating up? Is labor rates rising and creating inflationary problems? What they tend to do is they sort of get this momentum. And you've seen it in recent speeches that they're saying, hey, you know, full speed ahead, we plan on raising rates. They always throw in the typical little cautionary statement that gives them an out in case things change suddenly, especially if we get some kind of exogenous shock that nobody's expecting, like a jump in oil prices, a military conflict somewhere, or a financial bankruptcy. Because typically, when you have an over-indebted economy, as we have now in the corporate sector, the government sector, the consumer sector, when you start raising rates, somewhere somebody gets into financial difficulty. And these are the exogenous shocks that nobody can predict that show up out of nowhere, the black swans that kind of change things.
Yeah, I'm curious, Jim, are those the only things that you're watching? You're watching additional things? Although what's really puzzling to me is if you're watching these indicators, why doesn't the Fed watch those indicators? And maybe that's why they get a lot of their economic predictions wrong.
Well, they're following probably their own criteria. And, you know, I really think they're hoping they can normalize monetary policy and get the Fed funds rate into a level that they'll have some ammunition in the next downturn. That's, you know, it's kind of ironic. Hey, we're raising rates so we can lower them when we get in a recession. But the very fact that they're raising rates as much as they are creates the next recession. So one thing that we watch and has been a reliable predictor in the past, and that's the yield curve. And that's the difference between short-term interest rates and long-term rates. And typically, recessions are always preceded by either a flat or inverted yield curve. Now, an inverted yield curve would be where short-term interest rates are actually higher than long-term rates. A flat curve would be short-term rates are almost equal to long-term rates. And that's maybe what we see is a flattening yield curve, which is starting to happen now. And that can happen as, let's say the Fed raises interest rates this month. We'll have a Fed funds rate of 1.5, and they're predicting 3 to 4 rate hikes next year. Originally, they were talking about 3. They've been hinting at if the economy picks up in economic growth with fiscal stimulus, they may take that beyond that. So it could be 4. You know, whether they do that, I think it's, once again, we're going to be data dependent. If with all this amount of debt, if they keep, let's say they hike twice in the first half of the year, which would take the Fed funds rate up to about 2%, I would be amazed if we wouldn't start to see some kind of impact in the economy, in the financial markets, in the bond markets, by the time we get to the end of the second quarter of next year. So the yield curve flattens. The other thing that happens, predictably, anytime you get rising interest rates, what does that do? It makes it more expensive to borrow. So business investment starts to contract, and consumers begin pulling back as well. And then number 5 is you also start to see growth in the hours worked begins to recede, because one of the first things employers do before they do layoffs is they cut back on overtime or they cut back on the hours worked. So, you know, they try to avoid layoffs as much as they can. But so they originally start by cutting back on the hours worked. So that's a trend that we follow. And then predictably, what you see, the final thing is you see a cutback in either business investment because it's more expensive to borrow, and you start to see consumers begin to pull back on spending. So you see this showing up in retail sales. So those are the kind of things you want to watch, John, from a fundamental point of view, to give you a kind of clue. There's not one that you can point to and say, hey, that's it. When that happens, we're definitely heading into a recession. It's a combination of all of those things when added up together, give you a clearer picture in terms of where the economy's heading. And ultimately, and I might throw in a 7th one, is the stock market. The stock market will peak before the economy does. So you watch for weakness in the stock market, a narrowing of stock market leadership.
Well, I know you talk a lot about the LEIs, the leading economic indicators, so I'm going to assume that you're following that. But what about specific indicators you might put more credence in, more weight on than others?
Well, there's a couple of them. At the state level, we follow Medicaid enrollment, because as people begin to lose their jobs, Medicaid enrollment begins to go up, and that's the first sign to the treasurers of any state that their economy is heading into recession. We follow that. We follow the Philly Fed 50 state outlook, and that tells you what the states are doing. So it's not just looking at the broad economy of the entire country, but it's beginning to look at key states economically. When they start to go from green to yellow to red, you know, that's another confirming indicator. So I think all of those added up together. Once again, we don't use one. I mean, the LEIs are very important, but you have to use them in the context of other things that reinforce or support the direction that they're heading. And the best example I could give you was the year, I think it was year 2011, when the LAIs rolled over, our recession indicator got up to 20. It really looked, the stock market almost corrected by 20%, and it clearly looked like we were heading into an economic recession in a bear market. But things quickly flipped around, and we had one heck of a run up to the current point where we are right now with the economy and the stock market. So that's why you have to look at other things that surround the LAIs, because the LAIs don't necessarily predict 100% accurately that you're going to head into a recession. They are a leading indicator, which is why we call them a leading indicator or a leading economic index. But by themselves, you need confirmation from other sources, economic sources, that sort of support it.
Well, given that recessions generally lead to bear markets, what about the stock market?
Well, the stock market is one of those leading indicators in terms of where the economy is going. And we have seen a typical pattern that has existed over the last several decades. And that is, bonds are the first asset class to peak first. Why? What's happening? They peak because the Fed is raising interest rates, which means that bonds begin to lose their value. And then the second thing that begins to peak is the stock market, because eventually rising interest rates increase the discount mechanism on earnings, and it offsets rising earnings. So the stock market is the second asset class to peak. And then finally, the last asset class to peak is generally commodities. Now, Greg Weldon and I talked about in hour one that 2018 could be the year of commodities. So as we look at this, going back to bonds, one of the things that we're watching very closely would be the credit markets. If we see bond spreads begin to widen, which would indicate a bond market top. So that would be the first thing that we're really watching right now. And then, of course, we would expect eventually we would see a topping process in the stock market, where you have fewer stocks that are leading the index, as they are doing now. We call them the generals, the big large cap market stocks, the FANG type stocks, and the FANG stocks could come under trouble with rising interest rates next year. So we'll be following that. But the other thing we're going to be looking for, and this plays in with the rising inflation thesis, rising interest rates, and a more aggressive Fed, is a rise in labor rates and commodities. So we're going to be looking at oil, copper, gold, and base metals, and watch that. If that starts to rise as they're doing now and continues, then that would reinforce the inflation thesis. Basically, that's kind of like a green light for the Fed to start proceeding more aggressively. And of course, we know what happens. And so this is sort of the pattern that we follow, both in the markets technically, and then also what we follow on the economic side. So the two both go hand in hand, and you want the two to sort of confirm each other, because once again, there's not one indicator in the market, as Louise Yamada talked about in hour one, nor is there one economic indicator that you can say, that's it, you follow that, and that tells you exactly where you need to go.
If we put all this together, Jim, then how would you be invested for this final run before we assume things are going to roll over?
You know, you take a look at what typically would lead: energy, technology, industrials, and financials. Because as the yield spread, in other words, the difference between short-term rates and long-term rates increases, that's more profits for a bank. And also, I think you have to follow commodities, because that is, once again, if the economy heats up, there's a greater demand for commodities, commodity prices start to go up, that leads to higher inflation, which leads to more Fed rate hikes. And it's a pattern that follows one upon the other. And so I guess in the final phase, that's probably where I would be investing. And then as things begin to roll over, then you change your posture completely to more defensive sectors of the market, like utilities, consumer staples, and healthcare. But we're not there yet.
I'm guessing here from what you're telling me, it's like Ray Dalio at Bridgewater said, if you remember, everybody is still dancing, but if I were you, I'd be dancing a lot closer to the exit.
Well, as we have talked about, we're not 100% invested, but we are invested in the market 70 to 80%, but we're closer to the exit, because I just see next year could become more volatile due to Fed actions and response to fiscal stimulus. So, you know, we are just wide open and ripe for policy mistakes. And that's why, John, I think investors should be talking to their advisors for two reasons. One, this tax law change is a biggie. This is a big one, and it's going to affect you personally in your business, in your personal taxes. And number two, you should be talking to your advisor about having an exit strategy, because they don't ring the bell at market tops, and you know that eventually this comes to an end, and you want to be prepared for that to happen. You don't want to go through what you did in 2001 and 2002 or 2007 and 2009. So the time to start planning is now.
You're listening to the Financial Sense News Hour at financialsense.com. To speak to Jim Poplava or his financial planning team, call us toll-free at 888-486-3939. That's 888-486-3939. We'd be glad to help you plan your customized investment portfolio.
In case you didn't know it, the Financial Sense News Hour is more than just our weekend show. We also have a weekday program featuring key economic experts, which is only available to our premium members. Here's part of one of the interviews from this last week.
The new celebrity that we're seeing, known as a mesoscale convective system, a report was recently done describing that we have a strong possibility over the next century, through the remainder of this century, for these systems, I'm just going to call them MCSs from here on out, to become a more frequent occurrence in North America, especially in the U.S. in spring and summer. Now, what an MCS is, it's a collection of storms that spreads and covers a wider range of area than just your normal type of storm activity, your normal thunderstorm or blizzard or whichever else. They're more common in spring and summer, but they do also occur in fall and winter. And these storms are known to be some of the more devastating storm activity that we see in the United States. Because it can cover such a wide region, they move slowly, they last longer, they rain out more heavily.
Welcome back to the Financial Sense News Hour, that part of the program which we call the Big Picture. Jim Poplava, John Loeffler here with you. Well, Jim, I have a lot of problems, but I don't want to bother you with those. I'm going to ask you a question here, which is very important. I had a text message from a friend of mine today who thinks this tax bill is a watershed event. I'm not sure it's a watershed event as much as it is an important change. But the one impression you get, you know, people get tangled up in the politics of the nonsense, is the impact of it is really lost on not only the public, but also on, I think, state governments and what this really means. I don't know if a lot of them are coming to grips with this.
Yeah, I think some have. In fact, I think it's the newly elected governor of New Jersey that made a statement that they may have to rethink their tax policy, because he ran on a platform he was going to raise taxes on the wealthy to pay for government pension plans and teachers' pensions. And then all of a sudden, this tax bill comes up. And New Jersey is losing taxpayers, and is interesting. On Friday, I'm not going to mention the state, but I got interviewed by a government official in a state that is seeing an exodus of wealthy taxpayers. And this individual had listened to the show that we did on Lifetime Income on the great wealth migration. And their particular state was already seeing that. For example, in the state of Connecticut, where you had one hedge fund manager move his operation from Connecticut to Florida, and the state lost $200 million in tax revenues. And the state that called me to do an interview on Friday is losing hundreds of millions of dollars of tax revenues. And it's happening here in California, but the idiots that run the government keep raising taxes even more. They just passed another $52 billion tax increase this year. Taxes on tobacco, cigars, on vehicles, on gasoline. We're getting increases on utilities. I mean, everywhere the government keeps raising taxes, to the point where you've got a lot of lower middle class individuals that simply are struggling to make it here in the state, because all of those fees end up showing in your cost of living. They may not show up in the inflation index, but they do show up in terms of what you shell out to meet your monthly budget every single month.
And in addition to the idea of wealth flight, I think that's the one key thing is going to be this reshuffling of the deck between states. But number two, the bait and switch type of thing. So as they're rearranging or eliminating deductions and or exemptions in these bills, okay, they do that and they say, well, we're giving you lower tax rates or this benefits you over here. A couple of years from now, new Congress, new presidential administration, they just raise the tax rates back up where they were before. But now you don't have any way of building in defense, so to speak.
Well, you know, I even think that eventually on the federal tax side, they are going to run into problems because if they begin to raise federal taxes after they've taken away all the exemptions and deductions, what are you going to hear from the representatives and senators of high tax states? They're going to say, wow, you're killing us, because if they raise federal taxes, you can't control that. What can you control? You can control what you pay in state income taxes. And so it's just going to force individuals that live in high tax, high cost of living states to migrate and move to where there are either lower taxes, no taxes, and the cost of living is cheaper.
Yeah, and this does, you have to point this out, this does alter the economic landscape with the stimulus and what's going on in the markets. It's all combining together. So it is, like I said, I don't know if it's a watershed event, but it is major.
It is major. It's going to extend the business cycle because it's already long in the tooth. The reduction in corporate taxes is going to increase corporate earnings. So those two things by themselves would increase economic growth, would increase corporate earnings, which would lead to higher stock prices. But once again, the thing that's going to mitigate that is it's going to encourage the Fed to raise interest rates. And that's the thing that people really aren't grasping here, is you are now going to have monetary and fiscal policy come into conflict with each other. And in the end, the Fed usually wins as they wreck the economy. So it's ironic that they want to raise rates so they'll have ammunition to actually lower them when they get into the next recession, but their very actions will lead us to that next recession. And that's something that's going to be very big here.
You know, we've had this migration from the East Coast to the West Coast. This could actually become a new trend in seeing migrations from both coasts toward the heartland of the country, toward the central part of the country. Of course, what is ironic is that as the people do that move, then the states get greedy and they begin implementing the same failed policies that drove the people out of the other states. So, you know, they benefit from it, but then they follow in the same footsteps. But nevertheless, that won't stop the trend.
No, and this may get back to Meredith Whitney's book that she talked about. The next emerging market will be the center core of the United States. And that's what she was seeing back when she wrote that book 2 or 3 years ago, is a migration from the East Coast and the West Coast into the heartland of the country, where you have lower taxes, lower cost of living, governments that have balanced budgets and have less of the problems that you deal with the high cost of living on the East and the West Coast. And she saw that. Plus, that's where a lot of the natural resources from energy to mining are located. So her predictions, I think it was 2014, she came out with that book, The State of the States. And I think that is very well going to play out here. And this tax bill will only accelerate it. That's what I mean. The things that are being put in place have far-reaching effects that I think a lot of the politicians in Washington and even locally around the country. And of course, this is also going to impact the international markets. As the Fed raises interest rates, that's going to have an impact on the dollar. Think of negative interest rates in Europe and Japan. What happens when the Fed funds rate goes up here in the U.S. compared to, let's say, elsewhere, where they're still in Europe, they're still in the midst of quantitative easing, likewise in Japan? And if you look at these international interest rates, I mean, right now, a 2-year Treasury note is at 1.8%, reflecting the next rate hike. You take a look at the 2-year note in Germany, it is almost 0.75%. You take a look at the 2-year note in Japan, it is a negative 15 basis points. In Spain, it's a negative 40 basis points. In England, it is only a 0.5 percentage point. So if you have a lot of cash and you want to put your money in a safe place, one of the best places to put that money is in the U.S. So this is also going to impact the international markets. And that's what I think the markets aren't fully grasping right now, how big this is going to be. In fact, as we're doing this show, Kevin Brady announces that they're going to have a conference committee next week, and they're going to start debating this issue and hopefully get this tax bill to the president's desk before Christmas. And that's their goal. And like I said, this is going to have widespread effects, in many cases, unintended consequences that we can only guess at the present moment.
And it remains to be seen what the final bill is going to look like. Now there's a lot of horse trading going on. There was talk about bringing deductions back in and things of that nature. But ultimately, it's a time will tell type of situation as to how people react and what exactly it's going to do. And all you can do is wait for this whole thing to move on through. All right, that's it for the show for this week. What are we looking forward to? We're down into December now, looking toward the end of the year. Any bumps you see before the 1st of January?
Not really. I think the two big events, and one is widely anticipated, so no surprise there, is the next Fed rate hike, which is going to be coming this month. It'll be interesting to see if the Fed in any way changes its language. In other words, saying, hey, you know, we're thinking of 4 rate hikes next year instead of 3, or if it remains the same. So the Fed FOMC meeting and, of course, this tax bill. Those are the two biggies. But other than that, this trend is likely to continue well into next year, at least the first part of it. Well, that concludes this week's Financial Sense News Hour. On behalf of John Loeffler and myself, we'd like to thank you for joining us here for this weekend's show. Until we talk again, we hope you have a pleasant weekend.
You can subscribe to Financial Sense News Hour in the iTunes and BlackBerry podcast libraries, or at feeds.feedburner.com/FSM. Find more information about our guests at www.financialsense.com/newshour. Friend us at www.facebook.com/financialsenseonline. For our on-the-go listeners, you can access Financial Sense on your mobile device at m.financialsense.com. The Financial Sense News Hour is for informational and educational purposes only and should not be considered as a solicitation or offer to purchase or sell any securities. The investments, investment strategies, and investment philosophies discussed or presented on the News Hour each involve their own unique risk factors, which are not discussed on the show. Responses to listener inquiries are based on the personal opinions of James Poplava and do not take into account listeners' suitability, objectives, or risk tolerance. Financial Sense News Hour and its parent company shall not be liable for any financial losses that result from investing in any companies profiled on or advertising with Financial Sense, or arising out of the use of any material on the News Hour. Be advised that you invest at your own risk.